Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami.
So this next talk in the collection, volume 3 of the collected teachings of Lumpo Sumato, is called Being Nobody, and these talks come from the book The Way It Is, all being Dhamma talks given during the winter retreat here at Amaravati in 1988. So, chapter 19, Being Nobody. Try to note the cessation or the ending of things in little ways by paying attention to the ending of the out-breath. This way, in your daily life, you'll notice the ordinary endings to which no one ever pays attention. I found this practice very useful because it's a way of noticing the changing nature of the conditioned realm as one is living one's daily life. As I understand it, it was to these ordinary states of mind that the Buddha was pointing, not the special, highly developed, concentrated states. The first year that I practiced, I was on my own, and I could get into highly developed, concentrated states of mind, which I really enjoyed. Then I went to Wat Bapong, where the emphasis was on the way of life in accordance with Vinaya discipline and routine. There, one always had to go out on arms round every morning and do the morning and evening chanting. If you were young and healthy, you were expected to go on these very long arms rounds. They are shorter ones that the old feeble monks could go on. In those days, I was very vigorous, so I was always going on these long, long arms rounds, and I'd come back tired. Then there would be the meal, and then in the afternoon we all had chores to do. It was not possible under those conditions to stay in a concentrated state. Most of the day was taken up by daily life routine. I got fed up with all this and went to see Lumpo Cha and said, "I can't meditate here." And he started laughing at me and telling everyone, "Sumato can't meditate here." You can almost kind of feel the exchange, at least I can, the Lumpo Cha kind of very compassionately and kindly making fun of the young Bhikkhu Sumato, who's saying he can't meditate in his meditation monastery in the forest. Sumato can't meditate here. I was seeing meditation as this very special experience that I'd had and quite enjoyed, but Lumpo Cha was obviously pointing to the ordinariness of daily life. Getting up, the arms rounds, the routine work, the chores, the whole thing was for mindfulness. And he didn't seem at all eager to support me in my desire to have strong sensory deprivation experiences by not having to do all these little daily tasks. He didn't seem to go along with that. So I ended up having to conform and learn to meditate in the ordinariness of daily life. And, in the long run, that has been most helpful. It's not always been what I wanted, because one wants the special. One would love to have blazing light and marvelous insights in technicolor, and incredible bliss and ecstasy and rapture. Not just be happy and calm, but over the moon. But if you reflect on life in this human form, it's just like this. It's being able to sit peacefully, get up peacefully, and be content with what you have. It's that which makes our life as a daily experience something that is joyful and not suffering. And this is how most of our life can be lived. You can't live in ecstatic states of rapture and bliss and do the dishes. I used to read about the lives of saints who were so caught up in ecstasies they couldn't do anything on any practical level. The blood would flow from their palms, and they could do feats that the faithful would rush to look at, but when it came to anything practical or realistic, they were quite incapable. These are some important themes that that Lumpur focuses on here. First of all, that paying attention to the ending of the out-breath, and later on in the talk he goes into that some more, and this sort of ordinary everyday details, how the mind wants to go for the special experiences or have special conditions. But over and over again, Lumpur Cha would emphasize it's the ordinary everyday activities and being mindful in every moment. You know, that's the important thing. And so that rushing to get past this unimportant practical task in order to get on to doing the practice, it's something that Lumpur Cha would point to as being a seriously wrong view. And he would often tell the story of how when he was a young monk and he was living with Lumpur Kinari, who was a very well-respected Tudong monk, he left northeast Thailand and walked all the way to India and traveled on foot in India on Tudong for a number of years, and then walked all the way back to Thailand. And Lumpur Cha trained with him for some time, and he was making a new robe, and he'd started off sitting under the shade of a tree while he was sewing. There was no sewing machines; he was sewing by hand with a needle and thread. And he got so obsessed with the sewing, he hadn't noticed that the shadow of the tree had moved, and he was sitting in the blazing sunshine in the afternoon. And so Lumpur Kinari came along and said, "Tan Cha, why are you sitting in the blazing sunshine?" You know, and he said, "Oh, I hadn't noticed that the shadow of the tree had moved." And he said, "Well, why didn't you notice?" "Well, I want to get this robe finished." "Well, why do you want to get the robe finished?" "Well, I need to get this finished so that I can go and practice." And I think Lumpur Kinari said something like, which is a standard Northeast Thai expression of like, "Is that so? Or really? Or really?" Can mean a big variety of things. And then he sort of carried on to say, "Is that so? And then what are you going to do after that? After you've meditated, and then what? And then what?" And so that was a big insight for the young Ajahn Chah, and that he saw that just sort of, and also by watching the way that Lumpur Kinari operated, Ajahn Chah would say, he doesn't really seem to practice, he just sort of potters about and fixes things, and you know, he's not serious about the practice like me, and the young Ajahn Chah was there sort of driving up and down on his walking meditation path, doing so many miles on his walking path, he made it into a trench, And so he was extremely reflective and very, very wise. And he thought, "Well, okay, I'm calling this the practice." But Lumpur Kinari, he's a really wise monk and he's very peaceful. And how come he's quite content just puttering about the monastery, fixing things, and he's not sort of obsessive like me? And he really took note. And then when he asked the advice of the Ajahn, then Lumpur Kinari would point out that the Dhamma is here and now. It's how could the Dhamma not be present in the act of sewing, the act of cleaning a spittoon, the act of sweeping the sala or wiping down the steps of your kuti. You know, it's the practice of the Dhamma, the realization of Dhamma is always here and now. So if you're skipping over this to get to that, then you're always missing the Dhamma. You're always on your way somewhere. There's always that quality of becoming, sort of leaning into the next thing. You know, what now, what now, what now? And one of the ways that Lumpur Cha used to he was brilliant at coming up with extremely simple and direct practices. So in that light, and what Lumpur Sumedho is talking about here, just paying attention to the ending of the out-breath, Lumpur Cha would say, when you walk, just walk one step at a time. You don't have to walk in slow motion. You don't have to be walking in any kind of special way. But just as you're walking, just be with the step that you're taking, not sort of leaning into the next step or your mind already racing ahead to where you're trying to get to, but rather be with each step as you're taking it. just walking one step at a time. And at Amravati, it's not a huge campus, but even just moving around here in Amravati, going from the temple to your vihara to the sala, and back and forth, you know, how often, even though it's not, we haven't got very far to go, it doesn't take very long to get there, how often are we just sort of beaming towards the temple or beaming towards the vihara or the nuns' dwellings or the library or the sala, or, and dragged along by our bhava tanha, the desire to get somewhere. And just to relax into the act of walking, just walk one step at a time, being with one breath at a time. And that sense of watching the breath. And if you notice that for most people, the gap between the end of the in-breath and the beginning of the out-breath is shorter than the gap between the end of the out-breath and the beginning of the in-breath. That makes sense? So when you breathe in, there's a short gap before you breathe out. And after you breathe out, there tends to be a longer gap before the next in-breath. For most people, it's not a fixed thing. And the mind can very easily, in that out-breath, be eager to get onto the next in-breath. You don't stay with that relaxation, that sense of peacefulness, but the mind it gets eager for the next in-breath. And this kind of noticing of the out-breath and just being with that and not waiting for the next in-breath, not expecting or leaning into even the next breath, but just, okay, the out-breath has finished. There'll probably be another in-breath in a moment, but not yet. Okay, there it is. So just leaving the space that's there, just walking one step at a time, not trying to get anywhere, but just walking. And with the breath, just letting the breath be as it is, noticing the tone, the texture of the in-breath, and then the space between the in-breath and the out-breath, and then the tone of the out-breath and the space between the out-breath and the next in-breath, just being with that, attending to the feeling, the tone of those, and not trying to get anywhere with the breath, not trying to do anything with the breath, but just, here it is. The movement of the breath in or out is like this. The spaces between the inhalation and the exhalation, they're like this. Not being on the way to anything else, just being with that breath, as if it was the last breath. You know, breathe in, breathe out, and then, oh, no more in-breaths. Maybe I just died. Yeah. The peacefulness of that is the letting go of the becoming urge. The peacefulness of that is very, very profound. So then Lumpur Sumedho, even though he had this exchange with Lumpur Cha early on, he said, I can't meditate here. That wasn't the one and only time he had that kind of a conversation. And another of the well-known incidents was where they were building the road up to the hilltop monastery at Tamsang Pet, that Lumpur Cha had been offered this forest property, this sort of rocky hill, and a layperson had said, if you can find a way to build a road up to the top of the hill at Tamsang Pet, then I'll build a sala up on top. I'll pay for you to construct a sala on top of the hill. And previously, the local highways department had said, you know, the hill's too rugged, it's too rocky and difficult. You can't build a road up there, but Lumpur Cha went and camped out there for a week or so and walked all over the mountain and found a way that you could get a road up there. So then he went to this lay supporter and said, you know, yes, we can build a road, and yes, we'd like a sala on top. So it was a big Sangha project. This was in the early 70s that this was being done. And the young Ajahn Sumedho was part of the crew, but again, out there in the hot sun, breaking rocks and doing this road building. It's quite a long stretch of road up to the top of the hill. Once again, he said to Lumpur Cha, "You know, Lumpur, all this road work, it's really hard to sustain the practice while we're doing all this." This building, this construction, all the kind of breaking rocks and pushing things around in baskets and wheelbarrows and such like. I don't know if they had wheelbarrows in the Isan in those days, but certainly carrying rocks around in little wicker baskets and such. So he asked permission to Lumpur if he could just meditate. And so again, Lumpur Cha made an announcement to the Sangha saying, "Well, the Tan Sumedho, he's asked permission just to practice meditation while the rest of us are building this road. And I want you all to know that I've given him permission to do this. And so that none of you are to complain or criticize, he's got my blessing to go and meditate." And sort of Lumpur Cha could really perform, and he could kind of take things to that edge. It's like, is he making fun of me? No, he's serious. No, he's making fun. No, he's serious. No, what's going on? And so anyway, as Lumpur Sumedho would tell the story, he went off and sat by himself for a day or a day and a half, and all the time he could hear the noises of the work going on, and the hammers breaking the stone and people raking things, and so after a little while, a day or two, he began to realize, "I'm being really stupid," or, you know, "How many times has Longpoor told me this that this is the wrong understanding of the practice?" And so after a day or two, then he went and said, "Lumpur, could I join the road crew once again?" And sort of put himself back on the work team. And I feel it's this meditation on ordinariness, as he says, to learn to meditate in the ordinariness of daily life. So we can feel like, well, yeah, that's a bit of a come down. Or you, in the suttas, you hear about people being in some profound states of meditation and I want to have these sort of special, colorful experiences, or like he says, I want to experience marvelous insights in technicolor, have incredible bliss and ecstasy and rapture. You know, that can be really, the idea of that can be really appealing and exciting. But once again, I'd emphasize that, you know, the Dhamma is here and now. It's not somewhere else. So whether we happen to be sitting here in the temple listening to a reading, or whether we're sitting in the temple with our eyes closed and watching the breath, or out on a walking path, or we're helping to prepare the daily meal, or vacuuming the carpet in the vihara, how could the Dhamma not be there? How could the Dhamma not be here? And one of the things I often mention with respect to this, the word in Thai for ordinary is tamada, and it comes from the Pali dhammata, meaning of the nature of Dhamma. So right in the word for ordinary, you've got the word Dhamma right in, as you write the word tamada, it's spelt with the spelling of Dhamma. It's coming directly from the Pali word Dhammata, of the nature of Dhamma. So the clue is very, very obvious. So we call it ordinary, but hidden in the ordinary is the miraculous, is the Dhamma itself. So it's like the peeling of the fruit. You know, you peel the skin off the fruit, and then there's the flesh is there. So if we approach the ordinary and the utterly mundane activities, walking from your room to the temple, or standing in the queue for the meal offering, you can think, well, you know, I'm waiting to collect the food, or this is a mundane moment. I'm washing the dishes, or cleaning my teeth, or hoovering the carpet. You know, nothing special. But if we let go of dismissive or that worldly attitude, then the Dhamma is right here and now. It's just at this particular moment, there's this sensory arrangement, this pattern of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, thought. That's all. How could the Dhamma not be present? How could that ultimate reality of all things not be here? You know, where could it go? And so that it's that quality of being mindful and remembering awakening to that ever-present quality. You know, this is the challenge of the practice. Any questions, thoughts? Yes, Maureen, if you could use the microphone, please.
So my question has to do with, you know, when I guess we're instructed to guard the senses when we're moving through the world, let's say when we're, I mean, obviously when we're sitting in meditation, but in the case that you're talking about, we're supposed to guard the senses. So my question has to do with, I understand how to guard kind of the five physical sense doors. I mean, the way I've been instructed is, you know, as the sense door is being impinged on by its object, like, you know, to just, let's say it's, you know, someone's walking through the hall and they're stomping and slamming doors, if you can just stay with the sound and you just, you know, the hearing, mm-hmm. and then you just don't go to perception. So the minute you think, oh, that's a person who's stomping, then you kind of, you know, you've lost the game, you're already irritated. But if you can just stay with hearing, mm-hmm. and at each of the sense doors, mm-hmm. then we can kind of prevent that. But that I get. But with the mind, guarding the mind door, it's, I mean, I guess there's two things. One is the contact is so much more subtle, like a thought arising, there's no like great impingement. And then the second thing is that already at the point the thought arises, often perception's already happening. So I wondered if you could speak to how one guards the mind door in the kind of scheme of guarding the senses.
Yeah, well, good question. A few days ago, on a couple of occasions recently, I've been talking about how and Lumpur would be describing it in these teachings, how to develop mindfulness of thinking. So you pick it up as a deliberate practice, rather than just sort of trying to do it along the way, but you like make a specific practice. And so, because often we are only trying to be mindful of thought after some sort of distracted thought stream has already launched and it's sort of in the middle of its activity. So to develop a mindfulness of thinking, to make that a program really, and to sort of set yourself up as a student of how thought works. And then, as I was describing, you take a simple phrase, that you make the mind as quiet as possible, focused as possible, and then you take a very mundane, short sentence like, today is Wednesday. And it's not emotionally loaded, it's not personal, it's not a matter of opinion, it's just a very mundane, you know, today is Wednesday. And so, because it's deliberate, because it's non-personal, and because it's not emotionally charged, then it's easier to notice the silence before the thought. Then the thought is launched, today is Wednesday, and then there's a silence after the thought. So you can be fully mindful of that thought form. And then, you know, you can repeat that and go over it, and then notice how, in a way, the space of the mind isn't even interrupted when those words are there. You can see the space around the words, the concepts, if you see what I mean. Kind of the space between the words, you know, that today is Wednesday. And that, yes, the thought can be there, but it doesn't fill the space of the mind. It's not the mind, the attention isn't absorbed into it or making anything out of it. And then as you can develop, you develop that around very mundane short statements like that. Then again, as Lumpur was advising in an earlier talk here, he says you can take something that is personal, like I'm no good, or I'm a special person, or I told a lie last week, and I feel really bad about it. So deliberately, with a bit of emotional loading, a positive or negative or something, and something that's personal. So then to experiment with that, and then you think, I am no good. I am no good. Or I am special. And then even though that's got a bit more of a personal tone or an emotional tone, then anyway, it's like a, if you were weightlifting, you're kind of increasing your weights, or if you're running, you're going, you've gone from a half-mile run to a two-mile run. You know, you're stretching the system, and so you can make that development of mindfulness of thinking a deliberate practice. And so then, when you do that kind of deliberately, you're consciously arousing particular thoughts. You're following it as an exercise, just like mindfulness of breathing. Or you know, other kinds of deliberate practice, then when the patterns of thinking arise, then it's much easier to know, oh, this is just a thought, and you notice the space in the mind that is there around the thought. You find it much easier not to believe in the content of the thought, but just to observe the process of thinking. So it takes a bit of exercise to do that. But when Lumpur was explaining that kind of a practice back in the late 80s, you know, I found that so useful. Because if you're only trying to be mindful of thought when you're already kind of halfway through the first paragraph and you're kind of drawn into the story of liking this or you know, worried about that or obsessed by this or planning that and regretting this or reminiscing about that, it's kind of, you're already off and running, you know, kind of halfway through Act One, before you realize, oh, this is thinking. So that conscious development of that skill, it also helps to recognize that, in a way, as you're saying, that thought is just another sense object. It's not special. Our Western conditioning, particularly the sort of Greek philosophical foundations of the Western mindset, you know, thought has a very, very special place. You know, thought is kind of the ultimate reality. And pure, sort of pure thought or a pure concept, like Plato's ideas of the realm of ideal forms, pure forms. So that puts thinking into a bit of a different category. But the Eastern philosophy, and particularly what we have in Buddhist philosophy, Buddhist psychology, is that thinking is really just another sense object. So just like you can say, well, my eye perceives that color and calls it pink, or it calls this gray, that's just part of this perceptual system. It's nothing absolutely real. It's just the way that light and this eye and this mind and its language put it together. Then just similarly with thought, how a concept forms, how a memory or an idea takes form. It's not, how could it be anything absolute? How could it be anything special? It's just another sensory form. So that, and like when we are reading the suttas or reciting the suttas, you know, it just goes, like say the fire sermon, the Adita Pariyaya Sutta, you know, the eye perceives light, the ear perceives sound, the nose perceives odors, the tongue perceives tastes, you know, the body perceives tangible objects, the mind perceives dhammas. That's it. It's kind of, there's no difference. It's not like, here's a special category. It's just number six on a list of six. That's all. No big thing. So that, but that takes a lot of deconditioning because of the way that our education and the society makes thought different. You know, if I think it, it's true. And it's me that's the thinker. Those are really deeply ingrained attitudes, habits. But this kind of way of learning to be mindful of thought and to see thought is really just another sense object, then it sort of de-glamorizes it, and so that it changes the attitude towards thinking. So that's a few leads on that. Okay, so to continue. And yet, when you contemplate the Vinaya discipline itself, it's a training in being mindful. It's about mindfulness with regard to making robes, collecting alms food, eating food, taking care of your kuti, what to do in this situation or that situation. It's all very practical advice about the daily life of a bhikkhu, you know, any person really. An ordinary day in the life of Bhikkhu Sumedho isn't about exploding into rapture, but about getting up and going to the toilet, bathing, putting on a robe, doing this or that. It's just about being mindful while one is living in this form and learning to awaken to the way things are, to the Dhamma. That's why, whenever we contemplate cessation, we're not looking for the end of the universe, but just the exhalation of the breath, or the end of the day, or the end of the thought, or the end of the feeling. To notice them means that we have to pay attention to the flow of life. We have to really notice the way it is, rather than wait for some kind of fantastic experience of marvelous light descending upon us, zapping us, or whatever. Just contemplate the ordinary breathing of your body. You may notice that if you're inhaling, it's easy to concentrate. When you're filling your lungs, you feel a sense of growth, development, and strength. Literally, the word inspire means to breathe in. Spirare is the Latin for breathing. And to inspire is to breathe in. To be inspired just means you're breathing in. So you feel a sense of growth, development, and strength. When you say somebody's puffed up, they're probably inhaling. It's hard to feel puffed up when you're exhaling. Expand your chest and you have a sense of being somebody big and powerful. However, when I first started paying attention to exhaling, my mind would wander. Exhaling didn't seem as important as inhaling. I was just doing it so that I could get on to the next inhalation. I think it's a very mindful observation of how the breath works and how the mind wanders. It's also, Lumpur doesn't talk about it in this particular desana, in this Dhamma talk. But often when he talks about the Four Noble Truths, that he would often emphasize the third noble truth, the truth of Nirodha, Dukkha Nirodha, and that for each of the four truths, there's a way that the Buddha encourages us to work with them. So noble truth of Dukkha is Parinyayanti. It is to be understood or to be apprehended, to recognize, you know, here is Dukkha. Parinyayanti is to be studied, to be looked at, to be noticed. And then the second noble truth, the cause of dukkha, tanha, craving, is to be let go of, pahata banti. The third noble truth, so the cessation of dukkha, the thing to do with it, the task involved with it, is satchikata banti. It is to be realized. It is it's to be known. And then the fourth one, just to complete the set, is the Noble Eightfold Path is to be developed. So Lumpur would often emphasize the third noble truth, and particularly with this same kind of theme, when things come to an end, because of our strong habit of sort of looking for the next interesting thing, going to the next step or the next event or the next getting to the doorway or getting to the next object or the next thing, we overlook these kind of endings, you say, like the end of the breath or the end of the day or the end of the thought, the end of a feeling, that we have this habit, this sort of bhava tanha of leaning into the next thing, like what's next, what's next, what's next. And again, I'm not reading anybody's mind. This is just a very, very powerful habit. So satchikata banti, to realize cessation, is in a sense letting yourself, letting the heart fully imbibe, fully know that peace that comes with the ending of things, the thingness has ended. And rather than just skipping over that kind of blank spot to get to the next interesting thing or the next exciting thing or worrying thing or irritating thing, to let the heart be aware of that ending. One of the teachings that's most commonly used as a reflection, Lumpur Cha would very often quote it, and it's often recited. Part of the funeral chanting is Anicca Vata Sankara, all conditions are impermanent. Upada Vayadamino, having integrated, then they disintegrate. Vayadama is to disintegrate, to fall apart. Upajitava, having arisen, Nirujanti, then they decay, they end, they cease. Tesang Upasamo Sukho, and in their passing is peace, is sukha, is contentment. So Tesang Upasamo Sukho, so when a condition ends, there's peace. So peace doesn't grab our attention. Just like the other day, we were talking about silence and space, that they don't grab our attention. Yeah, or sometimes silence will grab your attention. If you're in the forest in Asia and all the crickets are going, and then when the forest suddenly goes silent, everything goes quiet, you go, oh, there's a predator around. Everything's gone quiet. So that's the one time when silence is more interesting than sound. It's like, why is everything so quiet? It makes you more alert. But generally, space, silence, stillness, they don't grab our attention. And the example that I most often give that is easy to relate to is how, say you've been engaged in some kind of a task, you've been doing the washing up, or you've been tidying your room, or doing your daily chore, kind of, hoovering the carpet, or you'd been doing some kind of building project, some kind of work, and then you finished your task, and you sit down and you go, ah, that's good, or you've emptied your email box. Finally, you know, all your flagged emails have been answered. Ah, my inbox is empty. And then you have that out-breath, ah, that's, thank goodness that's done. And then there's a moment of relief as the out-breath is happening. You plunk yourself down and go, ah, good. And then you have about 3 seconds of peace, maybe four. One, two, three. Then, okay, what's next? That peace becomes boring, it becomes insignificant, and the mind starts to look for the next thing to be doing, the next thing to be engaged with, the next thing to worry about. And it's not exactly the same for everybody, but probably that's a familiar experience. So the realization of dukkha nirodha is, rather than just having a worldly attitude or, you know, a self-centered attitude towards that peacefulness and skipping over that, saying, well, this ending doesn't really matter, or what's next, to just let the heart really take that in, to acknowledge, to open to that peace, that silence, that stillness. And then when that happens, then there's a kind of flowering, a kind of blossoming, a sort of the heart really fills with light. And that spaciousness, that peacefulness, sort of in a way comes alive. So that's the peace of Nibbana, is that living, bright peacefulness. It's like the energetic peacefulness that comes when the becoming urge is dropped. And so another of the statements I like to quote from the teachings is Bhava Nirodho Nibbanang. With the cessation of becoming, there is Nibbana. Nibbana is the cessation of becoming. When what's next? What now? In Latin, that's quid nunc. What now? What now? That when that's dropped, then the heart is enabled to awaken to the timeless quality of Dhamma. There's the experience of genuine peacefulness that comes with that. There's Nibbana is realized in that letting go of the becoming habit. Now reflect. One can observe breathing. So, what is it that can observe? What is it that observes and knows the inhalation and the exhalation? It's not the breathing, is it? You can also observe the panic that comes if you want to catch a breath and you can't. But the observer, that which knows, is not an emotion. It's not panic-stricken. It's not an exhalation or an inhalation. So our refuge in Buddha is being that knowing, being the witness rather than the emotion, the breath or the body. With the sound of silence, some people hear fluctuations of sound or a continuous background of sound, so you can contemplate it. You can notice that. Can you notice it if you put your fingers in your ears? Can you hear it in a place where they're using the chainsaw, or when you're doing exercises, or when you're in a fraught emotional state? You're using this sound of silence as something to remember to turn to and notice, because it's always present here and now. And there's that which notices it. There is the desire of the mind to call it something, to have a name for it, have it listed as some kind of attainment, or project something onto it. Notice that, the tendency to want to make it into something. It's been said that it's probably just the sound of your blood circulating in your ears. Somebody else called it the cosmic sound, the bridge to the divine. That sounds nicer than the blood in your ears, quote unquote. It might be the sound of the cosmos, or you might have an ear disease. But it doesn't have to be anything. It is what it is. It's as that. Whatever it is, it can be used as reflection. Because when you're with it, there's no sense of self. There's mindfulness. There's the ability to reflect. So it's more like a straight edge that you can go to keep you from wobbling. It's something that you can use to compose yourself in daily life. When you're getting dressed, brushing your teeth, closing a door, coming into the meditation hall, sitting down. So much of daily life is just habitual because we focus on what we consider to be the important things of life, like meditation. So walking from where you live to the meditation hall can be a totally heedless experience, just a habit, clump, 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 and then slam goes the door, after which you sit here for an hour trying to be mindful. But you can begin to see a way of being mindful, of bringing mindfulness to the ordinary routines and experiences of life. I have a nice little picture in my room, of which I'm very fond, of an old man with a coffee mug in his hand, looking out of the window into an English garden with the rain coming down. The title of the picture is Waiting. That's how I think of myself, an old man sitting at the window with my coffee mug, waiting, waiting, watching, watching the rain or the sun or whatever. I don't find that a depressing image, but rather a peaceful one. This life is just about waiting. We're waiting all the time, so we notice that. We can be just waiting. Not waiting for anything, but just waiting. And then we respond to the things of life, to the time of day, the duties, the way things move and change, the society that we're in. That response isn't from the force of habits of greed, hatred, and delusion, but a response of wisdom and mindfulness. Now, this is in a way the essence of insight meditation and the development of that quality of wisdom, of wakefulness, awareness, is being that, as Lumpur says here, that our refuge in Buddha is being that knowing, being the witness rather than the emotion, the breath or the body. That which observes and knows the inhalation and the exhalation, it's not breathing. So, and this is the kind of teaching to really take to heart. That which knows the emotion of regret isn't regretting. That which knows anger isn't angry. That which knows sleepiness isn't sleepy. That which knows selfishness isn't selfish. And even though we might hear words like that and say, "Whoa, Ajahn, you don't know my mind," That which knows the anger is really angry. Yeah. That which knows agitation is definitely agitated. Let me tell you. So these are teachings that are offered for reflection. They're not sort of things, commands. You're commanded to believe this or that you have to take this as true and real. But what I would encourage is just taking that as a principle or as a suggestion. Is that the case? Really? If the mind is agitated, so that which is like knowing that agitation, is that really? Is that not agitated? How could that be? How does that work? But you can use the sensory experience to get a feeling for how this works, so that, like, if you're hearing a loud sound, if, like, there's a lot of machinery working in the, like, on the nuns' building project, the nuns' nursing kuti, or there's a loud wind, it's been a windy day today, so the wind is sort of rattling through the windows, and so that which hears the noise, is that noisy? It's like, well, no, it's just hearing. So there's the noise, it's an intense sensory object, but that which knows the noise isn't noisy, it's just hearing it. It's noisy, the sound is loud, there's a big rattle or a big engine sound, yes. But yeah, that which is knowing it isn't a noise, it's not. It's knowing it, it's aware of it, but it isn't noisy. So then you translate that to emotions and see, okay, agitation. Yeah, there's the feeling of agitation, but is the knowing of it really tied to that? Is it identified with it? Is it fixed to it? And so slowly there's that, as we develop insight, the jitta sees things more and more clearly with less confusion and attachment, then those kind of sentences become meaningful. Oh, right, that which knows anger is not angry. That which knows sleepiness is not sleepy. That's probably the most challenging one, because the energy levels can be pretty dim if the mind is sleepy. So, but you can notice that. There can be an awareness of that. Oh, and another way that I like to reflect upon this is to say, and I've used this a lot recently in my own practice, is say, that which knows the person isn't a person. That which knows all the personal qualities, like being a man or having a name, you know, Ajahn Amaro, or being a monk, or being a, you know, Theravadan, or living at Amaravati, these personal qualities, that which knows the personal isn't a person. It's aware, it knows, but is it male or female? Is it old or young? Is it tall or short? What age is it? What color is it? What size is it? Those words don't apply. Color, size, gender, shape, age, they don't have any meaning, really, in respect to that. So that, in a way, it's not a kind of demand that you believe that, but I found that a really useful suggestion. So dropping that into the field of experience, that which knows the person isn't a person. It's not personal. Just like I don't own the light from these lamps, these lights here in the temple. Yeah, I don't own the force of gravity. I don't own the air that the sound of my voice vibrates in. I don't own the wind that's rattling around the windows. Yeah, it's ridiculous. Owning gravity, owning light, owning the wind is absurd, crazy. But yet we say, I own my body, or I own my thoughts, or I own my personal history. But again, if you can reflect on how obvious it is with things like light or air or gravity or... Thank you very much. Audio assistance to the theme. Yes, okay, it's experienced here, that sound or that feeling or that shape or that color or that idea, but what is there to be owned, and what could possibly own it? How can you own a thing, and who is there to own it? What is it that does any owning? So translating the obviously non-personal to the apparently personal, and investigating, exploring, and then slowly those habits of identification and attachment, you know, loosen up. Another expression I like to use to say develop this seeing, this insight is the jitta, the heart, is dhamma. It's not a person. The jitta is dhamma, it's not a person. The mind is dhamma, it's not a person. Again, not as a sort of categorical statement that you're expected to believe, but just to drop that into, because there's such a strong identification with the mind. I'm experiencing, I feel, I remember, this is my heart, my personality, my memory, my stories, my life. It seems so real and so strong. But looking at the nature of the citta, it's rather like the four elements of earth, water, fire, and wind. Yeah. Are they ownable? Light, gravity, sound, you know, are they ownable? Can they be owned? What aspect of the body and the mind is not part of nature in exactly the same way? Of whether it's physical or mental, every single aspect of body and mind, this body and mind and other bodies and minds, what part of it is not part of the natural order? So that to reflect in that way, so that the citta, it's part of nature, it's tamada, it's ordinary, it's of the nature of Dhamma, tamachat, it's born of the Dhamma. So then you introduce those kind of reflections, bring those into the field of experience, it gives a perspective on those habits of attachment and identification. And I find that those kind of simple reflective statements have a very powerful effect. So sometimes in the meditation, I'll just be using something like that. You know, the citta is Dhamma. The heart is Dhamma. The mind is Dhamma. It's not a person. And just, you know, every few minutes, just sort of dropping that into the field of awareness and just watching the effect that has. Or that which knows a person isn't a person. Just seeing the perspective shift. And then seeing how the person reassembles, you know, reconfigures, and comes back into being once again. But just seeing how that sense of I and me and mine, me this person, me this woman, this man, this this identity, this personal story, this nationality, this age, and so on, how that's an assembled perception. It's an assembled reality. It's not anything fundamental or real. It can't be. Now, speaking briefly about this picture, I don't know if Lumpur still has that picture, but before the temple was built, there used to be the old Dhamma hall here. It was like the school gymnasium and assembly hall, and there was a stage at the end of it, at this end of the hall, and then behind the stage there were these two rooms. And so for 10 or 15 years Lumpur lived in those two rooms at the end of the old Dhamma hall. And so this picture of the old man with the coffee cup was in the window of his main room. And so it sat there for years and years, and he really did like that picture. That's his kind of spiritual icon, this old man with a coffee cup watching the rain. And I heard the story that one of his attendants in later years, they started to do some research and they found out who the artist was. And then they tracked the artist down and told him, you know, there's this Buddhist monk who lives in Hertfordshire who really likes your painting. And then, again, I'm not absolutely sure, but I heard that the artist was like, really? Oh. And that he was quite touched that his picture was so loved, and also that there was a spiritual significance that it had. Yeah, this is this really really wise monk who lives in this Buddhist monastery in Hertfordshire, and he takes your painting as an important spiritual symbol. So I think, oh, he was apparently very very touched. I'd already moved to the States by that time, so I wasn't around. But apparently, a diligent Upatak did some research and found that out. So, any questions, thoughts? Yes, Anagarika, Anna Marie.
Maybe just a few reflections, because one thing I wanted to mention, like in Hungary, because I'm from Hungary, for me, if I hear like the one who knows, for me, I translate, for me that totally sounds like still like more like a person. It's not as you say with another sentence, like it's the mind. It's so, yeah, again, how we say things, it just makes so much difference for my understanding. That's one thing. And the other is about this like deeper states of meditation, because I don't see it.
Could
as
you say that again?
The deeper states of like jhanas, or like in the suttas you have it in many times, or that the Buddha was really like suggesting to, like, it's basically part of right concentration, and it's not, I don't see it as opposite that you are, for example, really concentrated how you walk. I think it's when you have meditation or deep meditation, it's basically just give more space to the same thing, to letting go, and not like ecstasy or something. And it helps to be more mindful during the day, so I don't see it as like an opposite quality.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, it's these kind of comments about ordinariness or mindfulness of the ordinary. We do spend a lot of time in meditation, like the retreat time, you know, and so that the teaching is encouraging of formal practice and such like. But this kind of comments that Lumpur Sumedho is making here is sort of trying to be a counterpoint, like a to balance out the idea that the real meditation is always formal practice, or is these deep states, or you got these colorful experiences and such like. So it's providing a perspective on that. But you know, we do spend a huge amount of time every day in formal meditation and encouraged to that. So it's really using both the formal meditation and the informal meditation consciously as skillful means, and not seeing the one as more important than the other. Certainly the formal practice, that when the mind is very, very quiet and that, you know, the system is very alert and very, very relaxed, then the fine detail of how the mind works and subtle kinds of attachment and identification and so on can be seen very, very clearly, which in the sort of rough and tumble of daily activity and engaging conversation or work and such like, it's more coarse. It's not so easy to see the subtleties. But it's you know, the point of that, so whether you're working on a road building or or sitting in meditation in a quiet place, it's to be in a sense having an equal attitude, an even attitude, and seeing that both of those situations and every variety of them can be, you know, used for the practice, and that balanced attitude is what's most helpful for most people. With and what you're saying about the one who knows, it's interesting, because that was in the early years of Lumpur Cha's teaching being translated into English, and that was often the way that it was put into English. The Thai expression is puru, and so that's literally, you know, pu comes from purisa, meaning a person. But it has a broad, I understand that in Thai language it actually has more of a broad meaning than just a person, and so that it's still kind of have that sense of there being a person who is doing some knowing, and so that Ajahn Buddhadasa and also Ajahn Jayasaro nowadays, Ajahn Buddhadasa passed away a number of years ago, but he used to use the expression Tatru, from Datu, meaning the element, so the element of knowing rather than the being or the person that knows, the pu, from Purisa. And so that Ajahn Jayasaro, who's very adept at Thai language as well as English, uses the phrase Tatru from Datu, meaning the element, so the element of knowing. And that depersonalizes, I mean, it's still very accurate, more accurate, I would say. It's less seen, less likely to be seen in terms of a personal quality. And so nowadays, I think it's less common that people will translate Puru as the one who knows. Although when they if they do translate it like that, they'll qualify that and say, using words like knowing or awareness or awakened awareness along with that. So, because it's a it can come across like there's this little sort of entity, this kind of what they call a homunculus. There's a lot of Latin in these readings. So a little kind of being that sits in your head and does the experiencing, the sort of an inner entity that's the experience, a homunculus. But that's a mistaken understanding. Yeah. Any final? Yes, Anagarika Michael, if you could use a microphone.
Thanks, Ajahn. I was reading some Ajahn Buddhadasa, and he advises that for most people, he's speaking about dependent origination, and he mentions that for most people, breaking the chain at the link of Vedana is the most useful practice. But he mentions that prior to allowing Vedana to arise, there's a way of breaking the chain which most people are not capable of doing. And I wondered if he's likely to be referring to absorption or more a kind of a dwelling in intuitive awareness, like without a subject-object perception in everyday experience.
I had the chance to go and visit Ajahn Buddhadasa to hear him giving Dhamma talks on a lot on dependent origination. Also, he talked a lot about atamayata, this quality of sort of non-dual awareness. And when he talked about that breaking of the chain sort of before Vedana and Tanha, if I remember correctly, he described it as being as at the level of contact. So between the six senses and Pasa, so before Pasa forms the Vedana. So, but he would say you have to be very mindful. Which I think it's a bit of an understatement to be able to be aware of sense contact before it gives rise to feeling, because on an instinctual level, you know, the senses operating, that they're very, very quick to generate feel, that they generate feeling before they generate the perception, so that. And it's interesting. It's another of those areas where the neuroscience backs up the Buddhist psychology, that you're turning towards what is attractive, and you're pulling away from what is dangerous, even before the mind thinks there's an object flying towards me. It's like your eye has the contact is there before there is even the feeling of this could be dangerous, or this could be an opportunity. That instinct works faster than sanya. But I would say that generally, and according to my memory of Ajahn Buddhadasa talking about it, he is saying that commonly, but they talk about breaking the chain between Vedana and Tanha, but if you're really mindful, then you can break it at sense contact, and that there can be the contact, and the mind doesn't create the feeling out of it. So I would say it's a rare skill to be able to do that. Speaking about atamayata, and he would use it again, if I'm remembering correctly, kind of as a quality very, very close to vijja, so that if the mind is established in that clarity of awareness, atamayata, which is a not creating subject or object, that in a way that's not letting the whole cycle begin in the first place. So it's sort of, if the mind is established in that clarity of non-dual awareness, of not that, atamayata literally means not made of that, or not thatness. So it's about not creating a subject-object duality. So that's, in a way, not letting the cycle begin at all. Just that. The mind so wakeful, so it's not giving any kind of solidity to subject and object, and then sort of by implication not giving any solidity even to the sense contact, the sensory process, that's clearly known and seen through even as sense contact is happening. That makes sense?
I'll have to, it's something useful to contemplate.
Well, yeah, that again, it was back in the late 80s that I went to visit Wat Suan Mok, so it's a long time ago. Yeah, it's nearly 30 years ago, over 30 years ago. But that's how I remember him describing it. And also people saying, but Tanajan, yeah, how do you do that? And he would just say, be mindful. So that degree of clarity, and the, you know, the training of the mind not to get caught in its distractions of liking and disliking, and making the sensory world into a solid external reality. That's, you know, years and years of practice of really reflecting on and looking at and getting to know the field of sensory experience, and training the mind not to be intoxicated by that, not to be drawn in by that. So that's how that degree of mindfulness can really be established on a sort of consistent basis. Okay, these hours fly by incredibly quickly. Let's leave it there for today.